Well, I thought it'd be good to begin by reviewing where we've been. I was on vacation last week, and we've taken a little bit of a break. So by way of introduction, good to remember where we've been. We've been looking at revivals and revolutions, 400 years of change. Some of the most dramatic change in church history comes in this modern church period, very rapid change. And as usual, we divide up these history classes into three different topics. The first is church growth and organization. That's really all we've been doing. Next week, we begin looking at opposition to the church from outside and from inside as well. And we've seen in this area of church growth and organization that in the modern church period, there are a number of very important movements that take place, and they're all related to one another. You remember we looked at the Puritan revival of the 17th century, and we saw how the Puritans built upon the solid doctrinal foundation that was recovered by the Protestant reformers. They had a high view of God, a high view of the scriptures, a high view of the gospel, and a high view of Christian experience. And you remember we've used this term a lot, experimental Calvinism, this balance of theology and piety, which the Puritans captured so well. And we've suggested that this is really the high watermark in modern church history in terms of theology, certainly in terms of confessional formation. But with the decline of Puritanism in the second half of the 17th century, everything pretty much goes downhill from there. Okay, we have an age of spiritual decline. We talked about that. We talked about the weakening of confessional orthodoxy with the Enlightenment and deism. We're going to look at that over the next couple of weeks. We also saw theological decline, spiritual decline, and of course, in its wake, you have moral decline. And society in the West begins to kind of do a downward spiral after the high point of the 17th century. But we also saw that Jesus was still building his church. And into this moral decline, we have this dramatic evangelical revival takes place in the 18th century. And we saw the different people involved with that. It broke out in continental Europe with the Pietists, the Lutheran Pietists. We mentioned Zinzendorf and the Moravians and others. And we talked about how they emphasized particularly the subjective elements of the Christian life, not so much the externals of the church and confessional orthodoxy and so on, but personal conversion experience and so on, and small group studies and this kind of a thing. We saw how that spread to Britain with the growth of Methodism. We talked about the Calvinist branch with Whitfield and the Arminian branch with John and Charles Wesley, and how they were itinerant preachers. There were massive numbers of people converted. And there was also in its train great innovations in worship with the advent of hymnody. Again, they borrowed from the Pietist small group structures, and really it transformed society. In fact, there's a thesis that you'll hear historians talk about, the Halevi thesis, that suggests that if it hadn't been for the revival, Britain probably would have had a revolution like France. And that's kind of, you know, who knows? It's kind of a debated thing. But the trajectory that Britain was on at the beginning of that century and where it was at the end is just cannot be explained apart from the direct intervention of God by sending revival. And even secular historians are baffled by that, but they have to concede something happened. Then, of course, in America, we talked about Jonathan Edwards and George Whitefield and their respective ministries as well. Then when you get into the 19th century, you remember the revivals take on quite a different character. We talked about Charles Finney and the new measures, the anxious bench, altar calls, trying to manipulate people's emotions to make a decision for Jesus. And then we start talking about how many thousands of people have been converted under our ministry. And it's the beginning of tent revivals and Billy Graham and where we are today in evangelicalism. We saw the aftermath of all that. It's very mixed fruit. There's great fragmentation following these revivals, new denominations being formed, hymnody and the worship wars begin. The parachurch ministry begins to take the place of the church, and pietism triumphs over this balance of experimental Calvinism. But this is where we start today's lecture. There's also an incredibly positive thing. Not only are people being, of course, converted, but there's a new stimulus to missionary effort that's going to flow into particularly the 19th century, but beginning in the 18th century. And we have to say that up until this point in church history, Christianity simply has not been a global phenomenon at all. It began, of course, in the Mediterranean world, and it spread into Europe and then over to America. But really, it was a Western phenomenon mostly. Of course, there are exceptions to that. But missionary work, there's a new explosion of fervor for missionary work that comes from this revival. And that's what we're looking at today. Making Disciples of All Nations, the Missionary Revival of the 18th and 19th Centuries. Let's begin where we have to begin, with Scripture. And the making of the Missionary Revival, of course, comes from the Great Commission. The Great Commission, we all know, Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. We've got to remember, as we're going to see the missionaries today remembered, this is more than just a project Jesus gave to the church. It's a prophecy. This is something that will happen. Matthew 24, 14, and this gospel will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. I'm not sure why this is, but I think it's easier for us as Christians to see God as the storyteller of church history in the earlier centuries of church history. But the closer we get to the present day, for some reason I think we can forget that He's still in charge. He's still on the throne. He's still working things out. We can see these big movements of history. Maybe it's because we don't seem to see revivals or massive reformations as once was the case. I'm not sure why it might be. But nevertheless, His presence will continue with the church to the end of the age. And so what we want to look at today is how has the church been actually achieving that goal? That there are eschatological factors here. We're looking towards the end of time. And many of the missionaries we'll be looking at today, I'll not really talk about this in the lecture itself, but many of them were motivated by this kind of eschatological idea that Christ is coming soon. And before He comes, the gospel needs to be preached to all people. So we need to get out there and do that. And there's great optimism in this period of time, particularly the millennial views of the time were very optimistic. A lot of Jewish evangelism in particular in this time, we're not going to talk about that so much today, but important to understand that this is the biblical underpinnings. If that's the biblical foundation, the biblical background, let's look at the historical background. Very quick roundup of where we've been in international missions in church history. In early church history, the Roman world is evangelized, okay? And we did that 3 or 4 years ago. Then you remember in the medieval period, the barbarian world is Christianized, and all the barbarians bow the knee to Christ. One by one, the tribes submit. Even the Vikings, you know, the sort of nasty peoples, you know. We watched that movie recently. How to Train Your Dragon. Have you seen them? Kids movie. I know the hearts love that. You know, and Katie said, Dad, what happened to the Vikings? You know, because these ferocious people and they worship these different gods. I said, you know what happened to them, Katie? They became Christians. And they became farmers. And they stopped murdering people. And, you know, and this is what Christianity does. This is what the gospel does. It changes hearts and lives and people settle down and stop murdering their neighbors. So anyway, barbarian world. Then you get to the Reformation. And this is where things take an interesting turn. There's actually comparatively little international evangelism in the Reformation period. There are a few exceptions. John Calvin sent some people to Brazil. There was a small colony in Brazil of Calvinists, actually. And the British, of course, in America, in the colonies, reaching the Indians. And Oliver Cromwell actually had this plan to divide the whole globe into four massive mission fields. And that really never got off the ground. But so there was good intentions there, I suppose you might say. I just want to say that the focus in that period is mostly internal. It's a little maybe sidetrack here for a moment. But why did the reformers not do international missions? And a lot of it's very fashionable today, even among Christian historians, to criticize the reformers and say, "Well, it's because they were all Calvinists; they didn't believe in evangelism." And it's like, well, just all you're saying is you don't know what Calvinism is when you say that. Okay, you can't do missions without an understanding of the sovereignty of God. But just in passing, it's important to say that it's true that the Catholic Church did far more international mission work than during the Protestant century. The Jesuits, for example, went to China and Japan, and also South America, of course, became a Roman Catholic bastion. But we need to remember that the Reformers served their generation by recovering a gospel that could be preached to the nations, right? They were focusing on what was going on in recovering the gospel that had been lost in the Middle Ages. And so it's just a little thing in passing here. The other thing to remember is that Catholic nations were beginning to build empires. Northern European nations didn't have navies, and they weren't doing that. Okay, so the Catholic Church had a natural venue to go over to South America and do that. And I might also say that you'll find a lot of historians will tend to clump Christian missionaries together, whether it's Catholic, Protestant, Pentecostal, whatever it is, it's Christian missions. And we got to remember, we need to be a little more discerning than that. I mean, when we say, oh, isn't that wonderful the Jesuits brought Roman Catholicism to Japan? Well, no. And oftentimes the gospel they brought was little better than the paganism they were actually there to convert these people from. You think of the verse in Matthew's gospel where Jesus says to the Pharisees, you travel land and sea to win one convert, and when he's won, you make him twice as much a son of hell as yourselves. So we need to be discerning with this issue of missions. It's not as clear-cut as, well, somebody calls himself a Christian, they go and plant a church, yay. Okay, we need to be discerning. And the reformers recovered a gospel to preach to the nations. And what we're doing today is we're seeing how that reformed gospel, the recovered gospel of free grace, then went out to the nations, and we see nations being transformed by it. So that's a little bit of a digression. But let's move on to the context, the immediate context. Yes, Jesus was building his church for 17 centuries prior to the period we're going to look at today. But as I said, it was hardly a global phenomenon. But in the last three centuries, there has been a massive explosion of global evangelism starting in the 18th and 19th centuries. And we have to ask why. What was the immediate context that brought that about? And I've just mentioned again, evangelical revivals. Now, the revivals of the 18th century revived the slumbering spirit of evangelism and energized the church to go forth to the nations. We also see the rapid growth of voluntary societies. We've mentioned this about how the national moral conscience of Britain and America was aroused by the conversions. That's certainly what we need in America today again. And there's a great deal of what today would be called activism, evangelical activism. I mentioned already today the pietistic emphasis upon parachurch societies. And what we're seeing in this period is that these parachurch societies are driving much of this evangelism around the globe. And there's lots of different issues these societies took up. Okay, abolition of slavery is the big one. Temperance societies, a lot of temperance societies as well. And of course, missionary societies that we're going to look at today. Another important factor to keep in mind is imperial expansions. Again, we got to remember that the divine storyteller is sovereign over these elements as well. You've got political and economic ambitions. European nations wanting to claim territories and expand their power overseas. You also have technological advances. This is the age of industrial revolution and the age of steam. One historian talks about the advent of Protestant sea power. Okay, and it's the fact that Protestant nations were now developing navies that were, you know, could rival anybody in the world, and particularly the British Navy, which of course is going to bring the gospel to the far-flung parts of the world. It's also sometimes called the Second Great Age of Exploration. First, of course, was during the Renaissance. You remember Columbus sailing the ocean blue and everything else. Well, now you got the same thing again. You got Captain Cook sailing the seven seas and discovering new islands that had never been discovered before, and new continents as well, actually. And you've got then the rapid colonization of the globe. And the British Empire is particularly, this isn't just because I'm British, but the British Empire plays a critical role in the story today. You may or may not have heard the slogan that the sun never sets on the British Empire. And that was a literal truth. At the height of the empire, the British Empire, Britain ruled over a quarter of the landmass of the planet. Think about that, okay? Of course, so the sun literally never set on an area that wasn't under British rule in some way. A fifth of the world's population was governed by Britain. It is the largest empire in human history, okay? And it happens at this time. What's God doing? Well, he's used empires in the past. We've seen that throughout church history. And the same is true here. That's why British missionaries are really going to come to the forefront in the story we tell today. So to summarize what we've said here, the world is becoming more accessible at the very point when the church is becoming more motivated. Funny, huh? Well, of course, it's not a coincidence. Christ is building the church, okay? All these things are together. The infrastructure is there. The global village is beginning, okay? And the beginning of the missionary to the missions to the nations is ready to go. One of the greatest historians of global missions is Scott Latourette. He says, never has any other set of ideas, religious or secular, been propagated over so wide an area by so many professional agents maintained by the unconstrained donations of so many millions of individuals. Now, that's quite a mouthful, but the point is this is a very, very well-funded and well-supported enterprise that's taking place. And there are people beating down the doors of churches saying, send me, okay? Incredible numbers of young people offering to go and die in the third world in this period of time. So it's an exciting time. And before we go on to look at the story itself, let me just also digress slightly and just point out another objection that you'll often hear. Again, it's fashionable, I think, a stereotype to say, well, these missionaries, you know, exploited the natives in the same way that their imperialist governments were exploiting their natural resources, and basically they're westernizing these people and we should have left them alone. And that's kind of the current sort of narrative that you'll hear from many historians. But it's interesting that new studies that are being done by historians are having to concede the fact that actually Protestant missionaries were far from sort of imperialist adventurers just bent on, sort of stealing the diamonds in South Africa or something. Okay, the civilization that the missionaries brought certainly strengthened these nations, okay, and helped them towards nationhood themselves. And we really ought to expect that Christian missionaries will be blasted by today's. I mean, when you think about it, they're committing what is today's unpardonable sin, enforcing your opinion on somebody else. They're bringing the gospel to these people. And it's common today for revisionist historians to look at what we're about to talk about and say, what a dreadful black chapter in history. We look at this and say, this is one of the most glorious chapters in the history of the world and the history of the church. Well, the rest of our study, I want to just show us some highlights of the missionary revival. I'm talking about peoples and talk about places. We're going to go on a brief tour of the world here in the next half hour, okay? We'll go from continent to continent, and we'll see a little bit of the story of what was going on in this period of time. We want to start with the continent of Asia. And we're going to find again and again, those pesky German pietists are always the first on the run here. They stretch out there and go places where Presbyterians and Baptists never thought of going. And often when Presbyterians and Baptists got places, they find, sure enough, there's a bunch of Moravians that were here a couple of years and beat them to it, okay? Which is great. But the pietists did a great job in blazing the trail in Protestant global missions. They went mostly where there were European colonies. Some names we've already come across, Count Zinzendorf, his Moravian missionary church. You remember it was established at Herrnhut in Germany, 1732. These guys were just missionary machines. They sent out 2,170 missionaries over 150 years. And this is a tiny little community all over the globe. You may remember the story of John Wesley coming back from his failed mission in America, and the ship's about to sink, and there's those pesky Moravians again, and they're singing praise, great, we're going to go down with the ship and go to heaven. And he's like, what's up with these people? And remember, the Moravians had a big impact on his own conversions. The Moravians were really blazed the trail. August Franke, we've mentioned him as well. The Danish Halle mission to India, 1705, one of the earliest missions into Asia of Protestants. They translated the New Testament into the Tamil language, Sri Lanka. But we have to move beyond that and see that the entire Indian subcontinent soon came to be dominated by Britain, and particularly through with the British East India Company, had its own flag and its own standing army. And this was just, we'd call this a mega corporation. This thing was a monster, okay? Like I said, they had a free hand from the British government basically to rule British interests in India, and their influence spread very, very rapidly. And it guaranteed that most Protestant missionaries in India would be British. Now, there are several key players we could mention, but the one I want to draw our attention to is, of course, William Carey, who's sometimes called the father of modern missions. And some question that. Some would say, no, we got to talk about the Moravians. They started up. But whatever way you want to fall on that particular position, Carey had a very important role to play in this missionary revival. He was a shoemaker, had a real heart for global missions. He was very heavily influenced by Jonathan Edwards and his writings. And he and several other Baptists, particularly Andrew Fuller, began prayer meetings. They began to pray for the conversion of the heathen. And they soon found there was a lot of opposition. The famous quote, one of the elders in his church said, "Look, son, if the Lord wants to convert the heathen, he can do that without your help," right? And it's worth saying in passing that many of the strict Baptists of the time were what we would call hyper-Calvinists, okay? They said, look, you just sit tight and God will zap those people and they'll become Christians, okay? The problem is, again, most historians, certainly Christian historians, look at that and say, typical Calvinist. No, Carey was the Calvinist. His church elders were hyper-Calvinists, okay? And so he retorted with a tract published in 1792 called An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen. That's Calvinism, see? God is sovereign, but he uses means. He uses the means of grace. And the same year, he founded the Baptist Missionary Society, 1792. And the motto you'll have heard before, expect great things from God, attempt great things from God. See? There's Calvinism, okay? God is sovereign, but we have a responsibility at the same time to use the means that God has given us. So in 1793, the next year, off he goes to Calcutta. Again, the East India Company are there. And interestingly, the East India Company instantly takes a dislike to British missionaries because they're actually helping these Indian people. And the East India Company are there pretty much to exploit these people. And so he has to get out of British India, and he ends up settling in Serampore, which is just around the corner in eastern India. And he settles in a Danish colony. And things start to happen, okay? He sets a trend for cross-cultural missions, okay? Yes, I know it's an immersion, but he was Baptist, that's okay. There he is baptizing all these converts. He saw incredible success. He and two others, he brought a teacher and a publisher with him. And that's strategic. You got a preacher, you got a school teacher, and you got a publisher. He's thinking strategically here, okay? And he's setting the standard for modern missions, okay? How does he set the trend? Well, you study the culture, okay? You study the languages, you study the customs, you study the religions. Carey wrote 6 grammars and 3 dictionaries for Indian languages. So, I mean, that's quite an achievement in itself. Another thing is, of course, you preach. You preach the gospel. By the end of his ministry, there were 1,407 baptisms of Indians, okay, all different castes, okay, cutting across the caste system in India. Translate and publish the Bible, of course, in Christian literature. The entire Bible was translated into 6 Indian languages, and parts of the Bible were translated into 29 more languages. That is just a breathtaking accomplishment, okay? Then you've got schools. They established several schools there, brings literacy and education. By 1818, 10,000 students were enrolled in 92 schools. I think that's 20 years after he got there. Unbelievable. Then you've got social and agricultural development. They're teaching these people how to modernize their agricultural techniques and so on, improving the local economy. We're going to see in a later study that in the 20th century, Christian missions became almost exclusively this. People talk about missions today and they think, oh, you went and did agricultural development in Africa. And that's good. There's nothing wrong with that. But the gospel and these other things here aren't in the driving seat anymore. Okay, so the balance is going to shift later on. But anyway, then indigenous missionaries, really, really important point. Carey realized that if they were going to establish an Indian church, it would have to be seen that Christianity isn't a British or a Western religion. Okay, they need to establish indigenous churches and train indigenous missionaries. So by the time Carey died, there were 19 missionary stations around Serampore, and they were staffed by 50 mostly non-British missionaries. This is, again, setting the standard of missions as we know them today. The other thing I've mentioned is parachurch missionary agencies. And these really are the vehicle for promoting missionary work in the 18th and 19th centuries. They're all, of course, linked to evangelical revival in some way. Just give you a couple of examples here. The LMS, London Missionary Society, 1795, sent missionaries to Asia and Oceania. The British and Foreign Bible Society, distributing Bibles in Britain and abroad. China Inland Mission, Hudson Taylor. I'm going to talk about him in a moment. It's interesting that this is just an interesting phenomenon. As Reformed Presbyterians, we look at this, and you know, there's different opinions on this particular issue. One historian praised the fact that this meant that they were free from the restrictions of denominational control. I just thought that was an interesting phrase, and I'm not sure I'm altogether happy with it. This is something that maybe you can discuss in an animated fashion over the lunch table today or something, but just as a stimulate discussion, let's just keep in mind that the Great Commission we began with was given to the church, okay? Go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them, teaching them, and baptizing them. You know, the sacraments aren't given to private agencies, right? They're given to the church, okay? So the apostles are given the commission. There's also the question of theological accountability. What often happened with many of these organizations, because they were ecumenical in nature, they had to kind of agree to a sort of lowest common denominator statement of faith. And that meant if a missionary was sent and he was, you know, strong Reformed Presbyterian. Well, he had a kind of couldn't really talk about that, okay? And often it meant that the message, well, it ran the risk of getting watered down. These early days, everybody was sound compared with today, but it's got a trail of wreckage after it. And then the question of financial accountability and stability. These agencies quickly found that they didn't have the benefit of the regular tithe that the church was given to the church. And so many missionaries ran into difficulties with financing and had to finance themselves, sending out support letters and so on. And again, this is something that we take for granted today. All I'm saying here is this is where it started, okay? But the churches themselves, the denominations quickly caught up, okay? There were church-based agencies that were formed as well. I'll just mention a few of the more well-known ones. Church Missionary Society, 1799, was the big one, okay? The Church of England, the Evangelical Party began this. The American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, ABCFM, sounds like a radio station, was a congregational organization, and the English Presbyterian Mission, obviously English Presbyterians, oddly enough, sent William Chalmers Burns to China and others. So I'm just saying it like it is. This is what happened, okay? And you know, you can dispute that. That's something you can talk about. I'll just set you up and you can go have an argument. Other people you should know, I'll just mention some of the well-known names, and I'll just say this is really to encourage you to go to the library, get a biography, and start reading. There's nothing like reading missionary biography. It's just exciting stuff, especially in these early days. It's like reading, you know, adventure stories, exploration, and you know, and lions, and you know, savages, and it's just cool stories. And these are solid Reformed Christians going blazing the trail. And it's exciting to see how the church was grown. You'll know these guys: Adoniram Judson. Top math student at Cambridge, associate pastor to Charles Simeon, missionary to India and Persia, translates the Bible into Hindustani. Well worth reading his biography. Henry Martin, that was wrong, that was Henry Martin. Adoniram Judson was the American, born in Massachusetts. Henry Martin was the guy that went to Persia. Adoniram Judson is best known for Burma. He went to Burma, worked with the Buddhists, and extensively studied Buddhist culture and writings, and incredible apologists against Buddhism, read Adoniram Judson's work. And then, of course, Hudson Taylor, founder of CIM, who takes the gospel to inland China, best known, of course, for actually being the first sort of Western missionary to actually dress like the Chinese. And everyone's like, oh, you can't do that, you know? What a shocking thing to do. And of course, if you're going to reach these people, you need to embrace their culture to some extent, insofar as it doesn't, you know, sacrifice the gospel. So another important name, he was also one of the early proponents of faith missions. Don't raise money, just go and the Lord will provide. And that's a story in itself. All right, let's move on to the Americas. We're going to move past South America. South America is, as I said, a Roman Catholic bastion. There really isn't any major Protestant push into South America until the 20th century. Okay, North America, of course, North America, America and Canada, United States, tends to be a sending nation rather than a receiving nation. The only exception, of course, is mission to Native Americans, and that began right from the beginning, 17th century. The first settlers, even the Mayflower, had a guy, a certain Robert Cushman, who was set apart in 1621 to present the gospel to the Indians. John Eliot is probably the best-known name of this period, who formed a society for the propagation of gospel in New England and translated the Bible into the Algonquin language. Let's see, 18th century, well, here we go again. There's those Moravians. It's amazing. The Moravians actually went into villages and married natives. And the British authorities were mortified. You can't do that. Well, you know, it's just racism, you know. But they saw great, great fruit. Whole villages coming to faith in Christ. They settled in Moravian churches, and they intermarried with the natives. And, jumped in with both feet. David Brainerd is probably the best-known name, a friend of Jonathan Edwards. His biography is a classic. I thought we had it in the library, but I couldn't put a finger on it. But the biography of David Brainerd, written by Jonathan Edwards, became a real bestseller. And it inspired a whole generation of missionaries to reach out to foreign peoples. 19th century, again, Second Great Awakening is going to be a great spur. Methodist missions to the Indians begin. You also have a lot of denominational missions. I'll just mention one. The Reformed Presbyterian Church had an Indian mission for many years to the Kiowa Nation in Apache, Oklahoma. And, you know, that's something you might want to be interested in, RP Church there. And the ABCFM, there's the radio station again, American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions. These guys went to Hawaii and transcribed the Hawaiian language for the first time, and wrote down their customs and so on, and began planting churches in the Hawaiian Islands as well. But we all know what the story of what happened to the Native Americans. And what you have is really two options, elimination or assimilation. And as the tribes on the plains, particularly, of course, nomadic people, very hard for missionaries to get among them and to follow them with the buffalo. It really wasn't until they were finally forced on a reservation that missionary work began in earnest. That's a sad story in itself. Just a postscript here again, if I could take aim at the contemporary historian establishment. Again, it's pretty typical for contemporary historians to lampoon Christian Protestant missions to Native Americans, you know, taking away their culture and everything else. The reality is, Protestant missionaries that went to Native Americans did more than anybody else to study Native American culture. And again, taking the likes of William Carey and others, you've got to go in, you've got to know the people you're talking to. You've got to study their language, study their culture, their customs, their religion. And of course, they wrote it all down. How can we bring the gospel to these people? And if it hadn't been for the Christian missionaries writing this stuff down, many Native American languages and cultures would be lost. Okay? These are oral cultures. Okay? And so the irony is that it's Christian missionaries that are to be thanked for preserving many of these customs, not because they wanted to preserve their, you know, their paganism or anything like that, but it's just an interesting irony of history that Christians who are so mocked for destroying a culture are actually the ones that preserved it in the end. So, interesting. Another discussion point for lunch. Let's go to Africa. I'm sure you've seen this picture before. One of the most ghastly images of history. It's the cross-section of a slave ship. And as you know, the African slave trade is one of the greatest abominations of history. I want to begin looking in Africa by talking about a group called the Clapham Sect. If you haven't heard of these guys, get to know them, okay? Clapham Sect and the abolition of the slave trade. There's a lot of connections between the evangelical revivals in Britain and this issue of abolition. Again, I've talked about how you've got the kind of this national conscience is aroused as many, many people are brought to salvation. You've heard the name John Newton, okay? Author of Amazing Grace. He's a converted slave captain of a slave ship, okay? Read his biography. Jonathan Aitken's biography is just one of the best biographies I've ever read, and we have it in the library. Read that biography, and it'll tell you about the slave trade. It is ghastly. This guy became a whistleblower. He came back and said, here is what is going on in the plantations. Here is what is going on with, you know, capturing slaves in Africa and so on. And you get a great deal of activism against this. And it's focused on this group called the Clapham Sect. It's a small group of very influential, mostly aristocratic, evangelical Anglicans. They lived in Clapham in London. That's why they were called it. That's not a very positive term. The Clapham Sect. That was the nickname they were given. Okay, some very well-known people. Henry Venn, the founder, minister, and a missiologist. He is the guy that came up with these three selves. If you're in the missions, you'll know that you've heard of this before. The role of the missionary is to primarily establish indigenous churches, which will be self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating. Okay, you heard it here first. Okay, it's not that others didn't have the idea, but Henry Venn is kind of credited with being the guy that came up with this three-self idea. Which is very important for foreign missions. Another guy you'll hear Gordon and I quote a lot is Charles Simeon. Charles Simeon was a pastor in Cambridge University, incredible preacher of the word, and he had enormous influence on raising a generation of students at Cambridge to be foreign missionaries. Sir Thomas Buxton, we're going to talk about in a moment, another MP and a key abolitionist, and the best known of all, of course, is William Wilberforce. Wilberforce, if you haven't read the book, you've seen the movie maybe, Amazing Grace. And you'll know that this is the MP that was very responsible for the Slave Trade Act, 1807, abolished the slave trade, and then shortly before he died, the Slavery Abolition Act of 1833, which emancipated all the slaves in the British Empire. And again, what we just said about the British Empire, that's a huge chunk of planet Earth, okay? Slaves being emancipated. It is an incredible achievement, and it is something well worthy of praise to God. I want you to see the connection, though, between abolition and evangelization. It's a very short step from this drive to abolish slavery and the drive into Africa itself with the gospel of grace. You see, the plight of the African slaves aroused likewise a concern for the spiritual plight of the African nations in the Dark Continent itself. And that was what it was called, the Dark Continent. It was unknown. It was terra incognita. And so what happened was the Clapham sect started the Church Missionary Society in 1799, and the goal was essentially to bring the gospel into Africa. Now, the name that you always associate with this, of course, is David Livingstone, and I'm sure most of you have heard of this guy before. His story begins, however, with the gentleman I just mentioned, Thomas Buxton. He had a vision for bringing the gospel to Africa. He published a book called The African Slave Trade and Its Remedy in 1839, and the remedy essentially was the gospel. But he had this idea of three C's, okay? We've got the three selves, and here's the three C's, okay? Civilization, commerce, and Christianity. If we can import these into Africa, he said, it will put an end to slavery. And, of course, it will bring the gospel to these peoples who have never heard of Jesus Christ. His idea was to open up West Africa. He led an expedition that was a complete disaster, okay? But it inspired David Livingstone, and he's the guy that really took this idea of civilization, commerce, and Christianity to its logical conclusion. He adopts the same basic philosophy of ministry that only the gospel can transform Africa and put an end to slavery. And so he's famous, of course, for his expeditions into darkest Africa. He was sponsored by the London Missionary Society. Later on, he was actually sponsored by the British government because they realized, wow, this guy is just crazy enough. This could be useful to us to open up new trade routes into the dark continent. And so they started financing him. So did the Royal Geographic Society. You know, he's an adventurer. This is going to increase our knowledge of the world in which we live. So off he goes into Africa, and when he's there, he sees slavery at its ugliest. He sees it at the point where slaves are actually being kidnapped from their villages by Muslims in East Africa and by other rival tribes in West and Central Africa. And he brings back absolute horror stories. It's a good thing the British Empire had stopped slavery, but they wanted more. They said, let's stop slavery at its root. Let's go into Africa and try to stop slavery by showing that it's not really economically viable. If we bring our trade, if we bring our civilization, slavery will just stop. That was the idea. But even more important than that, if we bring the gospel to these people, God willing, they will stop this crime as well. He called it the open sore of the world. His most famous expedition was the Zambezi expedition, 1862. It was a bit of a failure commercially, but it was significant because it opened up the continent to Christian missionaries. And this is the thing that's really most significant. Livingstone himself wasn't a preacher going into villages preaching the gospel, okay? He was more of a geographer, you might say, okay? He opened the continent. This is what he said. He said, the role of the missionary is to primarily establish indigenous churches, which will be self-supporting, self-governing, and self-propagating. He didn't really do much of that stuff. What he did was he blazed a trail. He became a national hero, and he said, "You need to follow me. Follow me into these areas I've been. I've drawn maps. You know where these villages are. Now you go follow." And his most famous speech he made in Cambridge University, this is what he said. It was at the end of his life. He said, "I beg to direct your attention to Africa. I know in a few years I shall be cut off in that country which is now open. Do not let it be shut again. I go back to Africa to try to make an open path for commerce and Christianity. You carry on the work which I have begun. I leave it with you." And that's what happened. He went back to Africa and he died. He died at prayer in this village. And they buried his heart in the village and they carried his body back to Westminster Abbey where he was buried. But he blazed the trail, you see. Another quote, I don't have it on the screen here, but he says, "I view the end of the geographic feat as the beginning of the missionary enterprise." See, he's known for his geographic feat. What was the significance for the church? It was the beginning of the missionary enterprise into Africa. So he says, "You follow me," and they did. And what happened is the British government added a fourth C, conquest. Okay? And things get a little ugly here. Okay? You have what is called the Scramble for Africa. And this is a story in itself. Let me just give you some statistics here. Basically, European political entities decide we want to claim as much territory as we can. They start carving up Africa at an astounding rate. At the beginning of this period, 1881, 10% of the African continent was colonized. By the end of this period, there was only 10% that wasn't colonized. Okay, so it's incredible growth of colonization. I'll give you some stats here. In half a generation, there were 30 new colonies, 10 million square miles of new territory claimed, and 110 million dazed new subjects. So that's the way one is where I put it, okay? I mean, just bam, 2 decades, and Africa has been taken by the European powers. Now, what's the significance for the church, though? The significance for the church is that in God's providence, along with the conquest, came the missionaries, and they flooded into Africa at an incredible rate. It became known as the white man's grave, of course. You know, most of them were slain by malaria before they could even get to the villages that they were trying to reach. And today, the interesting thing is that the roles have been reversed. Africa is now one of the leading centers of missionaries in the world. Africans are sending missionaries out, whereas back then, we were sending missionaries to them. And actually, the irony is some of the strongest churches in the world are African churches. And some of the weakest churches in the world are Western churches. And if you want a case study, just look at what's happening in the Anglican Church. The debates over, you know, gay bishops or whatever happens to be, it's the African bishops that are taking a stand on the Word of God. So it's interesting how times have changed. A couple of stats here. Christians in Africa. In 1900, there were 10 million Christians in Africa. 2000, 360 million. In one century. So it's remarkable. In the United States today, 260 million. You see how the roles have reversed, haven't they? Okay, I mean, everybody's saying, you know, the future of the church looks like it's going to be in the developing world. The church is eclipsing in America and Europe, and the Lord, of course, can send revival, can do what He wants. But that's the trend that we're seeing. A couple of other names just to throw at you here: Robert Moffat, Scottish missionary; Alexander Mackay; Peter Cameron Scott. He's the founder of Africa Inland Mission. Let's wrap up here with Oceania, far side of the planet. Only got one screen here. This is the final frontier. Remember the Star Trek, you know, space, the final frontier? Well, Oceania for the geographically challenged among us, Oceania is the term for Australia, New Zealand, and, you know, Micronesia, Polynesia, all the islands of the Pacific, okay? This is the final frontier for missions in the 19th century. And some really cool stuff we could talk about here. We're kind of out of time. Lots of political and geographic factors to mention here. I mentioned the voyages of Captain Cook. And boy, people are excited. He's discovering continents, you know? We didn't even know it was there. Antarctica, what's that, you know? And all this kind of stuff's going on. And there's a lot of national excitement. Let's go explore these new regions. And again, like Livingstone, he blazes a trail. Then you've got the penal colony in New South Wales, here in Australia. Down here, of course, Britain says, huh, you find this vast, empty continent. Let's send all our troublemakers there. And so they sent all the prisoners there, and they started these convict colonies. And, of course, with them went the chaplains. And by the end of the 19th century, the interior of the continent had been explored, and there was missionaries to the indigenous peoples there as well. And New Zealand was annexed as well by Britain in 1840, Treaty of Waitangi. There's a lot of stuff could be said about that as well. I mentioned the London Missionary Society, 1795. Their primary target was the South Sea Islands. And they sent 30 missionaries there to Tahiti in 1796. They established a base of operations in Tahiti. And the interesting thing here, it's a very difficult geographic area to get around because it's just ocean and a couple of little atolls here and there. And so it wasn't really worthwhile for them to go and plant missionary stations in all these islands for, you know, population of, you know, 50 people or something. So they came up with this idea of missionary vessels. And they had kind of these mobile missionary units that would sail around the islands, you see, and bring the gospel. And it was very effective, a very effective way of going forward. All right, people you should know. Richard Johnson, nothing to do with the pastor at Second RP, okay? He has a T in his name, okay? Richard Johnson was the first chaplain to New South Wales. He was the first guy to build churches in Australia. Okay, very, very important. He sort of lays a foundation stone for churches in Australia. His biography is worth reading. Samuel Williams was one of his assistant chaplains. He's the guy that brought the gospel to the Maoris in New Zealand. Okay, saw incredible success. Many Maoris were converted through his ministry. John Williams, oh, this guy's my hero. My parents used to read me the story of John Williams, the shipbuilder. We went on vacation. He was the guy that went to the cannibal tribes in the New Hebrides. And this guy was fearless, absolutely fearless. You know, he would tell people, you bring your idols onto my ship. And they just smash them up and say, see, your gods aren't real. Worship our God. And they did. It's incredible. I mean, a bit more complicated than that. Not showing much cultural sensitivity there, perhaps. This guy was, he went to the island of Eromango, and everybody says the most fierce people there don't go. And he said they need the gospel. And he went, and he was killed and eaten by the cannibals. And his impact of his testimony is a lot like Jim Elliot, you know. Just inspired a whole generation of young missionaries to follow. And you think, what a waste. But the Lord used him to bring many more. And of course, the most famous of all was John. Most famous of all was John Payton. John Getty's another one I could mention. But John Payton was, again, RP, to begin with anyway, has a very influential autobiography. As I said, it's a must-read, and it's an amazing story for you to read. This guy, by the way, John Getty, Getty's and Kettys aren't related, are they? Don't think so. John Getty, this guy here, he went to this island of Antietam, which is where John Williams had been, and this is what they said about his missionary. It says, when he landed on Antietam, there were no Christians. When he left in 1872, there were no heathens. The whole island was converted, and you've got these little isolated units, and it's remarkable sort of island hopping and seeing these churches. And many of these churches are still there today and flourishing. But I want to end with a quote from John Payton. This is, I just find this very moving. Here's John Payton. He's there on the island of Tanna, and this is the first communion that he had in his church. And he says, and this is after so many threats to his life. He says, at the moment I put the bread and wine into those dark hands, once stained with the blood of cannibalism, now stretched out to receive and partake of the emblems and seals of the Redeemer's love, I had a foretaste of the joy of glory that well nigh broke my heart to pieces. I shall never taste a deeper bliss till I gaze on the glorified face of Jesus himself. That's just power. Read the book. It's awesome. Okay, it's full of this stuff. This is the guy, you know, his wife and child, he buried them both in the first year of arriving. He would be days in a compound with the cannibals outside waiting to eat him. I mean, it's just unbelievable the story that this man went through. And yet churches were established there in these islands through his work. And again, you think of what Jesus said, you shall be my witnesses to the ends of the earth. And here they are, end of the 19th century, and it's been done. Ends of the earth have been reached with the gospel. Closing thoughts. We've looked at the missionary revival, 19th century. And we see that it is flowing from the evangelical revivals of the 18th and 19th centuries, which flow from the Puritan revival of the 17th century, which flows from the Reformation of the 16th century. It's all connected, you see. And there's purpose, okay, in what Christ is doing here in his work. It's an exciting period of church history. And the 20th century, missions continues, of course. There's the three C's, but look what's happened. Civilization, commerce, and Christianity. And we're going to look at the last century in our last study, and we'll come back to this area of missions, okay? And the sad thing is that much missions loses its course. To go in and preach the gospel is kind of seen as a bit insensitive to culture. Well, that's what missions is. The guys we've looked at today understood what missions was. Unfortunately, many mission agencies have lost that over time. Here's an application for you. Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even the end of the age. That commission hasn't been repealed as far as I know, and there are many, many peoples in this world that need to hear the gospel of Christ. And our church has mission agencies, and there are many other good agencies that you can support. But let's be praying for the prophecies to be fulfilled, that the gospel will be preached to all nations, and then the end will come. That's next week's class. We'll finally get the guillotine into action.